Greetings, Wilkinson here. Today I am recording in New York City, the Big Apple, and I'm with my old friend, not that he's old, but we're old friends, Kevin Finney.
Hey there.
We were just talking and trying to figure out where we met each other, and we decided what?
It was probably the lobby bar and probably had something to do with your photography, which I found eye-catching from Jump Street. And wasn't long after that that I asked you to take photographs of me and my then fiance.
Right. And then that led to you writing the wonderful intro to my first book.
Yeah. Well, thank you. You know, I considered it to be a real honor, mostly because contextualizing something as, would you call it, ephemeral as your ideas? You know, we had a lot of right. back and forth conversations about what the book was intended to depict and whether or not words could describe that adequately.
Right. And just so my listeners will know that the book was Naked Truth, Exposing Men's Souls.
And I'm in it, buck naked.
Uh-oh. You gave away the, anyway. So what I would do is interview people and hear their stories, and then I'd find out. We'd get down to their secret, a fear, something most people didn't know about them, and I'd paint those words on their naked body and photograph them.
Yeah, for me, so there was a musician that I interviewed some decades ago, and I asked him once what the most intimidating thing in the world was to him, and he said a blank piece of paper, because it could be everything or it could be nothing. Right. So what you do with a blank, you know, canvas is always fascinating to me.
Right. Well, we both moved on, because that was, again, well, I don't even know what year I did that book. I think 12, I don't know.
Yeah,
the book's there, but we won't take time to look it up. So let's hear a little about you, Kevin.
Oh, gosh.
I ask you before we start, we had a brief conversation. I haven't seen Kevin in, what, 10 years?
That's about right.
And I'm in town for a couple of days, and I said, we got to get together, and I have to interview you. So here we are. I'm in this very classy little place here. Love the brick wall.
It's humble, but it does have exposed brick.
It's cool. It's a cool place. Let's hear a little bit about your story. Since a lot of my audience are gay guys, let's hear your story. You can be brief on that. We'll get to other things.
About coming out?
Yeah.
Yeah. So coming out for me was, I was very, very late in doing so. I was probably in my mid-20s. I had been at the Daily Paper in Austin as the drama critic. I started there in 1982, which would have meant that I was 27.
Okay.
27. So I remember very specifically coming out the same week that Rock Hudson was on the cover of Time magazine as being an AIDS victim.
Really?
And I thought, well, just, you know, I'm coming out just in time to have there be an incurable disease for what I practice. And I remember there was a television critic who sat behind me in our little row of cubicles, and I turned to her wearing my sort of David Hockney mismatched socks and my little collection of buttons on my lapels, some of which were like from the FDR era, you know.
Well, that's a story, but we won't go there.
So I said, I have something that I want to share with you. And she said, uh-huh. And I said, I just want you to know that I'm gay. And she said, uh-huh. She was like the least surprised person in the whole wide world. Oh. And my family, you know, alcoholic, violent people, they had no position from which to issue moral authority about it. So it was a non-thing.
Huh. So you came out to them.
Yeah, it was, you know, here's my boyfriend, and if you don't like it, we won't come home for the holidays anymore. It was, I think the hardest part about coming out for me was AIDS, because I had a huge phobia about it. I went to my family physician 11 times in 12 months and said, what is this? What's going on there? And this was right around the time that the first tests were being developed. And finally, he said to me, I don't think the problem is in your body. I think the problem is in your mind. You might want to consider therapy. And I did. In fact, that fellow is the fellow that I stay with when I go home to Austin. Austin is my home away from home. And he's sort of my Obi-Wan. He and his partner, his former nurse, got married in Austin when it was only, you know, a ceremonial thing. And it was on CNN because it was such a big deal. They took out an ad in the paper. It was bedlam. As much noise as you could make is how much they made.
Wow. So it was sort of uneventful, your coming out.
Yeah, my own. Yeah, I think I had a much harder time coping with having alcoholic, violent parents than I did with coming to understand that I was gay. Being gay when in high school was hard because I grew up in El Paso. I was born in Brooklyn, but raised in El Paso. And in El Paso, there's such a cachet for machismo. You know, if you weren't butch, you were trouble. You were asking for it. And there was a guy, I can still remember his name, and I won't say it because God knows where he is, but his first name was Kurt. And Kurt was just Nelly as the day is long. And I saw horrible, horrible things happen to him. And it didn't make me rush to his defense as I wish I had. It pushed me deeper into the closet. And I hope he's okay wherever he is.
Yes. All right. So let's jump into it. So you're a writer.
That's true.
Let's talk about that.
Yeah. What would you like to know?
Give a little history of what you've done.
Well, so again, I started my journalism career writing for magazines and newspapers. My first published article, I think, was a review of Richard Pryor in concert with Patti LaBelle in Houston. And that ran nationally. And I was like on cloud nine about that. That was super exciting. Moved to Austin and began reviewing concerts and records and stuff. And then I was finishing up in college and my degree was in English and with a minor in theater. But I had been at Texas Tech for years. I was loving college. I didn't want to leave at all. So I did like 5 years at Texas Tech and then another two at a small Catholic college in Austin called St. Edward's University. And that's where I graduated from.
Were you studying theater or writing?
Well, that's the thing, right? So I was, when I went to Tech, my major was in journalism with a minor in political science. And then I changed my minor from political science to public relations. So I have enough hours to have graduated many times over. The guy who sat behind me in magazine writing class shot Ronald Reagan. The guy,
really?
Yeah, John W. Hinckley Jr. sat behind me in magazine writing class. And the day that the shooting happened, I had like 15 journalism friends who had jobs at, you know, the El Paso Times and, you know, the Dallas Morning News. And they called me and they said, "We found your name on a roster with John Hinckley." I said, "What was he like?" And I said, "Well, he was sort of a loner." You know, the things that people always say.
Yeah, yeah.
Anyway, so yeah, I was hired in 1982 to become the first full-time drama critic at the Austin American-Statesman. And there I stayed through the 80s. I got partnered, interviewed dozens and dozens of celebrities. They eventually expanded my role to being the entertainment writer at large. So I started to write about television, started to write about film, and I started to write about pop music as well.
Through your career, what else have you done? Writing-wise.
Oh, writing-wise. Well, so I've always sort of had a yen to, for me, the story is the primary thing, right? So sometimes the story tells you what milieu it wants to be in. I wrote a book, and the book is a history of race relations seen through music. And I wrote it around the same time that Ken Burns' series Jazz came out. But my book actually covers not just jazz, but gospel and country and blues and ragtime and hip hop and rock and roll and soul music and all the rest of it. And it was just an idea that wouldn't leave me alone. And so when I moved to LA, I left the Statesman at the end of 1990 and moved to Los Angeles and struggled for quite a while, but began to find work writing public relations materials for studios. Oh. And that led to a stint with Premiere Magazine, which was a really beautiful, great, big, glossy movie magazine with 5,000 word pieces that they paid $1 a word to write.
Oh, good.
And these days, you can't get $5,000 to write, you know, anything.
Yeah.
So oddly enough, the magazine was owned by Rupert Murdoch before anybody knew he had political leanings. So. From there, I got hired by The Hollywood Reporter and covered the awards season. So I was at the Golden Globes and the Oscars and the Grammys and what have you. But I just didn't like life in L.A. I didn't like life in my car. And was right after the Northridge earthquake and the Rodney King riots that my partner and I at the time decided that we wanted to go back to Austin. And that's when I moved back to Austin and started in radio.
Wow. What did you do in radio?
Well, first, I started out as a movie critic. I was there once a week, got paid in extra CDs, compact discs, not certificates of deposit. Got called on the carpet a couple of times for some filthy reviews. One of them, there was a movie called Crash. Helen Hunt, I think, and somebody else. Obviously, I want to say James Spader, but I'm not sure. But they were people who got off erotically on being in car crashes.
Right.
And
I never saw it, but I remember that.
I got in trouble for saying that the movie reminded me of feeding glitter to your dog. I said the results were interesting, but I wouldn't call it art.
Oh, my God.
And then there was Showgirls? That was, you know, legendarily sleazy movie. I said the last time I saw a movie this sleazy, I was pumping quarters into a machine to see how it turned out. Kevin, there are people listening. I have a long history of saying.
Did it create controversy with the listeners or was it just management?
It created a buzz, eventually. Small buzz, of course, but that led to me being invited to be the news guy. And after that went on for a while, I said, so the other guy on the show was named Kevin, still is named Kevin.
So Kevin and Kevin?
We pitched a show called Kevin and Kevin, and they accepted it. And so we did the better part of 10 years as a radio duo.
Wow.
And the thing is that he didn't like me very much at all because he thought that Kevin and Kevin meant twice as much him.
Oh, brother.
But I had, you know, I had a great time. When we got along, it was good. And when we didn't get along, it was even better. And every once in a while, we'd have a guest on who was loopy. You know, there was a woman who, for example, who came on who wanted to talk to us around Thanksgiving time, which is where we are now. She wanted to talk to me about how to make turducken. It's like, this is radio. No one can see this. I said, how much turd is in turducken? She looked at me like, I said, my doctor wants me to cut back.
Oh, brother. So did you leave there and go to Seattle from there or what?
I did. Actually, I left there just a month after September the 11th and moved to New Orleans because my partner was in medical school, or actually leaving medical school and going on to a residency. So we were there for 2.5 years while he finished his residency. And then he got an opportunity to go to Seattle for a fellowship. And I got a call from my old radio program director asking me if I would like to come back and be on the air again. And I said, oh my God, yes.
And where was this at?
That was going back to Austin from New Orleans. So I went to New Orleans for 2.5 years. That's where I finished the book, came back and did another 2.5 years of Kevin and Kevin. And that's when my partner convinced me that I had to move to Seattle, where I was. I guess I was in Seattle for about 9 years. I've been in New York now for about as long as I was in Seattle.
You're moving somewhere else now?
No, if I leave New York, I'm going back to Austin.
But, oh, are you?
Yeah, yeah. But I love it here. I live 5 blocks from Times Square.
Right.
And it's very noisy. But I wouldn't trade it for the world.
They were doing something outside your building when we came in.
Yes, they're working on the gas lines.
It's pretty noisy.
These buildings are 125 years old. So they're in constant need of repair. By the way, if you're looking to come to New York and get into business, scaffolding, because they're always fixing buildings up.
Right. Okay. So what have you been doing in New York writing-wise?
When I arrived, I found myself working for a small, although national, magazine called Metro Source. And my editor, lucky for me, had faith that I could do all the things that I came into his office boasted that I could do. And he had been, we had a publisher who was just an awful human being, just one of the worst people I've ever met in my entire life. And he had just browbeaten my editor to a point of misery. And he was, you know, when you've been plowed under that many times, it does a number on your desire to achieve. And he was all too happy to have me take over everything that I could. So he was basically the guy who laid out the magazine, approved about half of the stories and assigned about half of the stories. And I did most of the covers. And I really wanted to launch us into a different atmosphere than we had been in. Before I arrived, we were doing celebrity interviews, but here's how they would work. You would send off a questionnaire to the publicist and you'd get replies back. So you don't even know if the celebrity actually saw them or even signed off on the answers. But every single one of my pieces, I was either looking at that person or hearing that person's voice. So Zachary Quinto, Don Lemon, Tim Gunn, all of those people, you know, Sean Hayes, who told me that he'd never play Jack again because he'd grown up too much. And then they offered him a whole bunch of money.
Oh, yeah.
For the Will and Grace reboot. And he said, I'm there. Nothing wrong with that, of course.
Do you have any interesting celebrity interview stories?
You know, so it's always really fun, as you know, because you're a good interviewer, it's always really fun to lead somebody to their own sense of enlightenment. And sometimes people are resistant to that. When I interviewed Zachary Quinto, for example, it was just as he was beginning rehearsals for the Boys in the Band revival on Broadway. And we started to talk about the character that he was playing, Harold. And I said, you know, Harold just seems to be manipulating everybody on stage and that he seems to be three steps ahead of everyone. And Quinto was having none of it, which is fine. Sometimes it makes it more interesting.
Right.
But he said, you know, he didn't think I knew what I was talking about, which is great. So it did make for a more lively conversation. In the book, I interviewed a guy named Bill Withers, the guy who wrote Lean on Me.
Okay.
And he basically gave me a quote that leads my book off saying, I think race relations is far too serious a topic to be discussed through something as frivolous as entertainment.
Mm.
Okay. That's like, your book shouldn't exist. Your book's a horrible idea. Wow. All right, let's put you first. So, you know, I don't mind that kind of engagement. At the same time, you can't help but love it when... So I interviewed a guy named Alan Arkin, the late actor, right? And I interviewed him on the set of The Rocketeer, which was one of the early superhero movies of the early 90s.
I remember it.
That guy, Joe Johnston, went on to direct the first Captain America movie, which is really still great. But I'm interviewing Alan Arkin, and I said, so if all the things in your career have led you up to this point, and he goes, uh-huh. He's like in it to win it, right? He's eyeball to eyeball. I said, so if all of these things have led up to now, what do you think is next? He said, as a personal goal? I said, sure. He says, my goal is to get out of this interview before you know me better than I do.
Uh-oh.
Which I took as a huge compliment.
Right.
And people often say, so they'll find out that you've interviewed so-and-so, and they say, angel or asshole? Can I say asshole on the podcast?
Yeah, you can.
All right, you can bleep.
If it's 5 minutes into it, we can do it. That's YouTube.
The truth of the matter is, you know, people are people, and you and I and every other person on the planet has been both an angel and an asshole. It just depends on when you find them, you know, and some people feel more entitled to be jerks more often.
So of all the people that you've interviewed, who have been some of the angels who impressed you?
Oh, some of the angels. Well, so it was my job at The Hollywood Reporter to call the nominees of the Academy Awards when they were nominated and get their reactions. And I found that, so this was the year of The Prince of Tides, the Barbra Streisand film.
Right.
This was the year of JFK, the Oliver Stone film. This was the year of a little movie called The Silence of the Lambs.
Whoa. That was a big year.
I found that Sir Anthony Hopkins was just Anthony Hopkins at the time, was doing a movie he was putting in a cameo in a Robert Downey Jr. movie called Chaplin, a biopic about Charlie Chaplin.
Okay.
And I found him because, you know, agents and publicists, they want this stuff splashed all over. So I found him, it was like early in the morning in Switzerland where he was doing this cameo, and he gets on the phone with me, and I'm the person who tells him that he's nominated for an Academy Award for Best Actor.
He didn't know it?
He didn't know it.
Oh, really?
And he was so on cloud nine that it took me 20 minutes to get a paragraph out of him. We had to sit there and go over the sentences one word at a time until he said, yeah, I think that's what I mean. And then when I saw him the night of the awards and he actually had a statuette in his hand.
Did he win that year?
He did.
He did. Okay.
He did. We were standing in a small circle at one of those five-star hotel after party things.
Yeah.
And my editor, who had assigned me to the story, so I don't know why he was so starstruck, but I'm standing there with a little semicircle of people around me. There's Jonathan Demme, who is the director of The Silence of the Lambs. The only real friend that I made the entire time that I was there, her name is Callie Curry, and Callie was screaming my name as I'm walking in, and it's like, who is that, and why are they calling for me at this kind of a party?
Right.
And she's holding up her Oscar for the first script that she ever sold, a little thing called Thelma and Louise.
Whoa.
And I walk over, and there's my editor standing next to Callie, and next to, on the other side of him is Jonathan Demme and Sir Anthony Hopkins. And she says, it's heavy, hold it. See, so I'm now standing there holding her Oscar. And she says, do you know Jonathan Demme? I said, hello, Jonathan. And my editor's like, looks up like, why are you so familiar with these people? Like, dude, you assigned me to talk to them. Of course I would know them. And she says, do you know Sir Anthony Hopkins? And I said, hi, Tony. And Tony says, hello, Kevin. So it was delightful. And it was instrumental in my leaving because I was on cloud nine for the next day. And then I remembered that there was a girl who worked for Mel Gibson's production company. And she said how much she loved her job because when Mel wanted a bottle of water, he called her by name. And I thought, that's not my life. No, thank you. I don't want to be famous, or I don't want to be satisfied that some famous person knows me by name. So I packed up and I went back to Austin, and that's
really
the radio thing started.
Wow.
Yeah.
What did you do primarily in Seattle? Besides writing the intro to my book, of course.
I walked and trained my dog. I did the laundry. I went religiously to the gym. I was with a trainer three times a week. I was training a boy who became a lover and I brought to New York. And I tried to keep the person who was my fiance and became my husband off my back about what he saw over time was me. He believed I was a gold digger. So yeah, that was a problem. I moved twice, first to New Orleans and then to Seattle. And the only person I knew in either one of those cities was him. And I moved because I loved him. And he knew that he was a doctor or about to be one. And we didn't have any needs for material things because he made a six-figure income. And yet he raged about me not producing or going to a job or quitting journalism to do something that brought in money. And I showed him an outline for a second book that I proposed. And his response was, well, I guess you don't want this one to sell any better than the last one.
That's encouraging.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. Whereas, you know, my boyfriend now, Ryan, I said, I'm so nervous about this movie I'm writing. He said, I wouldn't be if I were you. I said, what if I fail? He said, you won't. I said, how do you know that? He said, because you won't let yourself.
Whoa, whoa, whoa. Wait, you're writing a movie?
I am, yeah.
You didn't tell me that part.
I'm writing a movie. I'm a tour guide half of the week, and the rest of it, I am, I'm a licensed tour guide, by the way. And the rest, I'm writing a movie.
What's it about?
It is set over a 7-day period of time in 1977 in the summer. It's set here in New York. It's about a guy who's about to get his big break in LA to be on the Johnny Carson Tonight Show. And the talent scout who comes to see him goes backstage after he crushes it and says, I'm ready to put you on TV. There's only one thing I would like first.
Casting couch.
Hot sex. And so my guy, my protagonist, attacks him. And the police show up. And all of a sudden, he's radioactive and no one will touch
him. He's the bad guy.
That's, you know, there are several people who are not good. Anyway.
Is this based on a true story?
No.
No.
No. Okay. But there's a lot of factual stuff in it. So Mitzi Shore, who is Pauly Shore's mother, if you've heard of Pauly Shore, the comedian, Mitzi owns this place called the Comedy Store. and that's where he was performing. Okay. So she calls in a favor, and he winds up here in New York working on the staff of Saturday Night Live. So it's 7 days in his life, and it contains visits to CBGB with the punk place. There's a night at Studio 54. There's a night where they go to see the Blues Brothers. And right there in the middle of the week is the New York City blackout. All of this happens during the period of time that the Son of Sam is running around loose. And
wow.
So it's got a zillion moving parts. And it's a docudramedy. So it's documentary stuff, lots and lots of research.
Just giving me the list of all the things going on. I never would have put all those together. So it's really interesting.
Oh, bless you.
Yeah.
I'd sell you a ticket if I could.
Okay.
Yeah, keep your fingers crossed. It's called Live from New York.
That sounds pretty good.
And under the small print on the poster is going to say, before it was an institution, it was a madhouse.
Yeah. So you're writing it and then you hope to sell it?
No desire to be a filmmaker. I'm a storyteller, you know, and just like I had no desire to write a book before this idea about race and music hit me and wouldn't leave me alone, I've no desire to be just writing movies. I have an idea for a TV series, but that's after this. I'll do a treatment for the TV series. So as I said to you, you know, we've known each other for a very long time, and every once in a while we get together on Facebook and we have a good, you know, serious conversation. Right. I'm happy to the universe yank me out of the game at any point, as long as I'm finished with my work,
right?
As long as I'm done, or I've done as much as I can do, because my life's work, I think, and I do this on the bus tours too. You know, I'm the only tour guide who gathers people around in Central Park and says, I want you to look around. And I say, not at the scenery, look at each other and realize what a miracle it is that we're all together. You know, Neil deGrasse Tyson talks about what a miracle it is that each one of us, through unique combination of sperm and egg, are human beings at all. If that's unusual and that's a miracle, how much more of a miracle is it that we, all of us disparate folks, on the same bus on the same day, look around and realize that you could make a friend for life today?
That could be a movie. I can see it.
Well, I hadn't thought of that, but it's a blessing for you to say so. Yeah. So yeah, I think my life's work is, and the book is about the same bloody thing, right? It's about showing that the differences between us are not nearly so great as the commonalities among us.
And yes, sir.
You know, a gay guy says that, you know, right?
Right.
I've been marginalized my entire life.
So I just want to pop off here of all the cities that you've lived in.
Yeah.
So let's go Austin.
Yeah, yeah.
LA, Seattle, and New York. What's your favorite city and why?
Oof. Well, it's, you know, I'm in Austin as often as I can afford it. And there's something about A, the food, and B, the people. Austin, I always describe Austin as it is to Texas as Vatican City is to Italy. It's its own little fiefdom, you know,
right,
with Willie Nelson as Pope. So it's a marvelous and a magical place, brimming with creative people and ideas. And the newspaper is a horrible shell of what it once was. And it was never very much of anything. There were some really magical and talented people who worked there, but it was a crappy newspaper nonetheless, because that's what the owners sort of wanted to be, just a profit machine. I can't pick between New York and Austin, which is why, you know, if the movie sells, if I was to get rich and somebody said, okay, now let's see that TV series, we'll make you wealthy, I would have a place in New York and a place in Austin. I can't stand people say, well, you know, how have these various places affected you in your life? And I would say that my manners and my taste in food is all very Texan, and my sensibility and my desire to, you know, engage my mind and practice empathy, it's very Northeastern.
There's a Texas barbecue near here, right?
Yeah. So here's my strong advice: is don't eat Mexican food in New York and don't eat Italian food in Austin. there's some good stuff, but it pales by comparison.
Right. All right. Well, I would keep going forever, but we need to wrap it up because my friend is going to come and pick me up.
Yes.
I'm staying with the other Kevin, my other friend.
Kevin. Yeah. Not the Kevin of the radio Kevin.
No, the other Kevin.
A better Kevin.
Yeah. So anyway, I usually wrap these up by asking my guest, so what have you learned in your life? What are some lessons or what do you live by that you could pass on to my listeners?
Well, you know, I'm sure it would be very trite to go over the golden rule. I find that if you conduct yourself with dignity, 9 times out of 10, people will treat you the same way. If you think that you're going to enjoy a life whereby you hide from your greatest gifts, I got to tell you, that's the one thing that you'll regret, that you didn't swing for the bleachers. And I'll be 70 in a year and 2 months, and I'm still swinging for the bleachers, and I would advise every single human being to find out what it is you think you do best and go at it as hard as you possibly can.
The universe always sends me the right people at the right time, so I'm going to be mulling that over as I fly back home.
Excellent. It's so good to see you. It's great to spend time again.
It is great. Thank you for letting me do this.
My delight, sir.
Great seeing you, always.